Today we have Ken Winkle, who is the Thomas C. Sorensen Professor of American History at UNL. He's an award-winning author, and his books include The Politics of Community, Migration and Politics in Antebellum Ohio, The Young Eagle, The Rise of Abraham Lincoln, The Oxford Atlas of the Civil War, Lincoln's Citadel, The Civil War in Washington, D.C. His books are highly respected. They've won a number of awards. And most amazingly to some of us who publish books, they're read. It's not only published, but they find a wide audience. And I think the wonderful turnout for this talk today is evidence of the kind of interest in Ken's work and publications and his presentations. His talk today is called, as you can see from the board, Land of Cotton, Textiles, and the Civil War. It's really a pleasure to welcome to the center Professor Ken Winkle. Ken?
Thank you, Rick, for your introduction. Before I begin, I want to thank the Center for Great Plains Studies for inviting me to speak this afternoon, particularly because this lecture series is named in honor of such an inspirational scholar, teacher, and colleague, Paul Olson. I have been asked to address textiles and the Civil War, so I call this presentation Land of Cotton. It's very sensitive. Oh, heavens. That's the sneak preview. There we go. On April 11th, 1865, the day after Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered, Abraham Lincoln delivered his last speech to a crowd of thousands standing on the White House lawn. When he was done, he asked the U.S. Marine Band to play Dixie, which puzzled many members of the audience, along with many historians ever since. Dixie was the unofficial anthem of the American South, sung by a homesick Southerner. It begins, "Oh, I wish I was in the land of cotton. Old times there are not forgotten. Look away, look away, look away, Dixie land." Dixie is usually portrayed as a uniquely Southern song and intentionally bears the cadence of an African-American spiritual. But it was not composed until 1859, I'm getting my centuries mixed up here in the 21st. It was not composed until 1859 by a white man, and in fact, a Northerner. Daniel Decatur Emmett of Ohio was a performer in the minstrel shows that toured both the North and the South before and after the Civil War, feeding on the racial stereotypes that were so prevalent throughout America during the 19th century. Belying the song's Southern roots, Emmett first performed it in the North, in New York City. Hence, the homesick singer who longs to return to his native South, the land of cotton. Written by a Northerner and first performed in the North, the song quickly gained a national following. Emmett published the song in June 1860 in the midst of the heated election campaign that made Abraham Lincoln president and thereby precipitated Southern secession. The Confederacy never adopted it or any song as a national anthem. The U.S., for that matter, had no national anthem during the Civil War and adopted its official anthem only in 1931. But After Dixie was played at Jefferson Davis's inauguration, it became the unofficial Confederate anthem. Despite its recent composition by a Yankee, Confederates quickly concocted a myth that embraced it as a traditional Southern folk melody. Still, even during the Civil War, Northern audiences delighted in singing the chorus. I wish I was in Dixie. Hooray, hooray. In Dixie's land, I'll take my stand to live and die in Dixie. As president, Lincoln loved to listen to it. He had it played often inside the White House. Arguably, in 1860, when Emmett published his song, all of America, both the North and the South, was a land of cotton. Today, four natural fibers predominate in our clothing: wool, linen, silk, and above all, cotton. Europeans brought all four of them to colonial America. In Eurasia, wool and linen predominated in the northern latitudes, cotton and silk in southern latitudes. Sheep, the primary source of wool, originated in Europe and Central Asia. Flax, the source of linen, originated in what is now the Republic of Georgia. Europeans began weaving linen cloth 12,000 years ago and woolen cloth about 4,000 years ago. Silkworms are native to China and Southern Asia. Europeans transplanted sheep, flax, and silkworms around the world as they conquered and colonized. Cotton alone has always been global. It is native to tropical and subtropical regions, including Southern Asia, Africa, South America, and North America, especially Mexico. Cotton plants thrive in a latitudinal band ranging from 35 degrees south to 37 degrees north, where temperatures rarely fall below 50 degrees. The northernmost boundary of modern India lies at exactly 37 degrees north. And cotton was first cultivated 5,000 years ago in the Indus Valley, what is now Pakistan. Silkworms have a geographical range from northern India to northern China. Domesticated silkworms originated in China, where they were selectively bred over the course of 5,000 years. So traditionally, Europeans produced only woolen and linen fabrics. Alexander the Great introduced Europe to cotton cloth during the 4th century BC, and the Romans wore it. After the fall of Rome, Western Europeans lost contact with Asia and stopped wearing cotton. They resumed their acquaintance with cotton and silk during the Crusades, beginning around 1000 AD. Okay. Oh. Oh my. Oh, heavens. Oh, I can't get. Can somebody? I'm sorry to ask. Oh, heavens. Oh, I had it for a second. Oh, my. One of the cardinal rules of teaching, I'm told, is never skip a PowerPoint slide. so much for that. I'm sorry. I should have practiced. It's that one. Not a hold. Thank you. Europeans obtained both cotton and silk through the complex network of Asian trade routes known collectively as the Silk Road. This so-called Eastern trade in general, and particularly the infusion of cotton and silk, helped to lay the economic foundations of the Renaissance, which began in Italy around 1200. Easier to work and more comfortable to wear, cotton ultimately supplanted wool and linen as the fabric of choice in Europe. Oh, thank you. I'll get the hang of this. During their conquest and colonization of North America, Europeans brought all four natural fibers to what is now the United States. Wool and linen to the northern colonies, cotton and silk to the American South, mirroring the geographical division that had held true for millennia in Eurasia. The Puritans who settled New England brought the age-old folk technology of spinning and weaving wool and linen that they had long practiced in England. William Bradford, governor of Plymouth Colony for almost 30 years, for example, was not a minister, but a linen weaver. The Puritans and other New England families produced most of their clothing by hand at home. As in most traditional cultures around the world, with only rare exceptions, textile production was considered the responsibility of women. Women and girls, typically their daughters, engaged in a year-round cycle of textile production. In the spring, the men would bring the sheep down from the foothills where they had sheltered during the winter, would fleece them with shears, turn the raw wool over to the girls, who would card it using fine-tooth wire combs to tease it, to remove debris, and spread the lanolin through it uniformly. The girls would then turn over the combed cotton to their mothers, who would spin cotton wool over to their mothers, who would spin yarn. Spinning was a long process. A wife and mother might spend an entire summer constantly spinning enough wool and yarn to clothe her entire family. When the spinning was done, the weaving began. All done by hand. And women had the choice of either spinning the raw wool and leaving it a natural color, or dyeing it first. When they dyed it, they produced their own natural dyes from bark, berries, and nuts. They would stew the dye in a dye pot over the open fire for days on end, which made the cabin unlivable. They could dye the yarn and produce patterns in the finished cloth, or they could wait and dye the finished cloth a uniform color. When the weaving was done, the sewing began, and women single-handedly produced one suit of clothing for every family member. The wool shorn from the sheep in the spring produced woolen clothes in the fall that the family could wear during the winter. But in the fall, the process of linen production, redding, spinning, weaving, dyeing, and sewing would begin, and that would occupy the women and girls throughout the winter. And the lighter, cooler linen would be ready for the family to wear in the spring. England brought both cotton plants and silkworms to the southern colonies. Cotton came to Virginia in 1621, around the same time that commercial production of cotton cloth emerged in England. The English could not grow cotton for themselves. They had to import it from their colonies, including America and India. And they helped to turn the American South into a reliable source of cotton fiber. The first slaves had arrived in America only 2 years earlier, so slavery and cotton took root almost simultaneously. 7 years after importing the first cotton plants, Virginians also attempted silk production. But the silkworms were unsuited to the climate. They died, and the experiment failed, which left cotton as the only viable fiber for extensive cultivation in the southern states. At this point, the North and South diverged. Sheep and flax were best suited to a cooler climate, so Northerners could produce wool and linen at home. Cotton culture observed the same latitudinal limit as in Eurasia, 37 degrees north. Richmond, Virginia lies on the 37th parallel. So that is where Southern cotton culture ended. At first, both sections imported cotton cloth from England. But the independence movement brought a self-imposed embargo on importing cloth from the British, and the war and independence itself cut off imports entirely. Northerners reverted to wearing homespun woolens and linen, which became patriotic. Southerners began growing more cotton for themselves. But there was a problem. Southerners grew long staple cotton, also called sea island cotton. The fibers are loose and silky and easy to separate from the seeds. But long staple cotton could grow only in the low, wet soil of the coastline, literally on the sea islands off the coast of Georgia and the Carolinas. So the supply of long staple cotton was finite. The solution was short staple cotton, which could grow almost anywhere in the South below 37 degrees latitude. Short staple, called American upland cotton, is very hardy and today grows around the world, accounting for 90% of global cotton production. But the fibers were extremely difficult to separate from the seeds by hand. Southerners needed a machine that could separate the fibers from the seeds. Oh my gosh. Oh, heavens. Oh, good. You can do it.
I will do it.
On the right, up and down. Now we're out of it in time. Yes, you are. I'll keep going. Yes. Thank you. Southerners needed a machine that could separate the fibers from the seeds. That was the cotton gin, which is widely regarded as the most important invention between 1790 and 1860. The gin was invented by a Northerner, Eli Whitney of Massachusetts. Powered by a crank, the cotton gin could tease out the seeds. Is it up or down? Thank you. Thank you. Tease out the seeds from the short staple cotton 50 times faster than slaves could by hand. And this is a contemporary engraving of the picking and the ginning of cotton in the field. With the invention of the cotton gin, production began to skyrocket. Thank you. As the production of cotton fiber increased, textile manufacturers wanted a machine that could spin cotton into thread. And looking at the table, 1790, the South produced 1.5 million pounds of cotton. 10 years later, 7 years after the invention of the cotton gin, 35 million. And then there's about a doubling of the cotton production in the South every decade until the Civil War. Thank you. So textile manufacturers wanted a machine that could spin the gin cotton into thread. That was the spinning jenny, which was invented in the same year as the cotton gin. They went hand in hand. But now the South faced another problem. Spinning jennies ran on water power. The South's rivers were flat, wide, and slow. They couldn't power water wheels without extensive improvement. New England's rivers, by contrast, descended from the rocky coastline, and they were steep, narrow, and fast. They were natural water power sources. So the South began shipping its cotton, its ever-growing supply of cotton, to New England textile mills for processing into thread. Northern textile production, and therefore it's the North cotton consumption, took off. New England mills boasted 8,000 spindles in 1808, 80,000 spindles 3 years later in 1811, 800,000 spindles in 1825, and over 5 million spindles in 1860. As the output of the spinning mills grew, manufacturers wanted a power loom to weave the cotton thread into cloth. The power loom was invented in England, and after the War of 1812, it came to America, again to New England, to the water power. The emergence of mechanized cotton ginning, spinning, and weaving in the late 18th, in the late 18th and early 19th centuries is called the Cotton Revolution. But this economic revolution had dramatically different impacts in the North and the South. Just as the introduction of cotton to Europe helped to spark the Renaissance, an economic revival and a cultural awakening, The Cotton Revolution propelled the North into its Industrial Revolution. Cotton textile production quickly became the largest industry in the United States in terms of capital invested, workers employed, and the value of its output. Between 1850 and 1860 alone, output from New England's textile mills increased 62%. After the invention of the sewing machine in the 1840s, ready-made clothing quickly joined cloth production as America's leading and most lucrative industries. Elias Howe's home sewing machine, this was originally designed so that women, northern women, could buy cloth from the weaving mills and make clothing for their own families at home, as they had always done. They had always spun and woven the cloth. Now they could buy it. But later, the sewing machine, it's represented by the Mackay Stitcher, was adapted to the manufacture of ready-made clothing in factories. The first markets for ready-made clothing, by the way, were in the South. Plantation owners produced cotton with slave labor, shipped it north, where it was spun and woven, and now sewn into ready-made clothing, and they bought one suit of clothes per slave from northern textile mills once a year. In 1860, the production of clothing equaled the output of raw cotton cloth for the first time. And of course, eventually, fantastically larger amounts of ready-made clothing were purchased than bolts of cotton cloth. As a host of other industries adopted the mechanized production that had been applied to textile manufacturing, the effects of invention, industrialization, and innovation rippled through the North's economy, as well as its society and culture. The processing of cotton, not its cultivation, stimulated the Northern economy and triggered a minor scientific revolution that we might be tempted to label an American Renaissance of sorts. The New England textile mills spun off a host of additional industries based on mechanized production powered by water and later steam and still later electricity. My favorite example is the Jacquard loom on the left, which was programmable. It was invented in France in 1801. If you look at the cloth to the left, there's an intricate and beautiful pattern woven into the cloth. It's done by a machine. The loom was programmable. The punch cards told the machine when to lay down strands of different colors. In 1893, much later, a U.S. Census Office employee, Herman Hollerith, invented a way to record and calculate the demographic data on the 60 million Americans who had just been counted in the 1890 census. Inspired by the cards that programmed the Jacquard loom, Hollerith invented a punch card that could store information, count, and calculate. Well, you may have guessed by now, he went on to found the Tabulating Machine Company, which early in the 20th century became IBM. So the Jacquard loom inspired the modern digital programmable computer. This is the most improbable example of how the cotton textile industry stimulated innovation and revolutionized the American economy. Meanwhile, the Cotton Revolution had the opposite effect in the South. The Northern economy diversified and expanded, but the Southern economy grew increasingly dependent on growing a single staple crop, cotton, as its economic lifeblood. In the 1830s, the American South was already producing the majority of the cotton consumed around the world. And by 1860, two-thirds of the world's cotton. The value of cotton exports soon exceeded that of all other American exports combined. 50% of all U.S. exports in 1860, when American cotton represented 88% of all British cotton imports. Cotton was the South's most important agricultural product by far, and its most important product of any kind. But the result was economic stagnation, in contrast to the economic vibrancy that the processing of cotton imparted to the North. Unlike the industrializing and urbanizing North, the South remained agricultural and rural. By 1860, the North was 37% urban, the South only 11%. Instead of diversifying their economy, Southern plantation owners used their profits to buy more land and more slaves to grow more cotton, and a cotton belt swept across the South and into the American West. It came to be called the Cotton Kingdom, and cotton gained the popular label King Cotton. During the 1850s alone, Southern cotton production more than doubled from 1 billion pounds to 2.25 billion pounds. But the real profit in cotton lay not in growing it, but in the mechanized production of textiles, almost all of which took place in the North. In 1860, Northern mills consumed just 20% of the South's cotton output, but per capita income in the North was almost 50% higher than that of the South. Above all, Southerners remained committed to slavery, and indeed grew more committed to slavery with every passing year. Before the war, one-fourth of all income in the South came from the labor of slaves. As the cotton belt grew, so did the demand for slaves, as did the price of slaves. By 1860, slave owners reaped more income from the sale of slaves than they did from the sale of the cotton that the slaves produced. Cotton production based on slave labor bound the North and South together in an unholy alliance that the abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison condemned as a covenant with death. This was the fatal flaw that drove the North and the South apart. By 1860, the two sections were economically complementary, the South producing an ever-growing supply of raw cotton and the North processing it into ever-growing quantities of cloth and clothing. But the North's industrial transformation produced a cultural revolution that increasingly challenged the morality of slavery, even as the infusion of cheap Southern cotton continued to fuel the region's economy. During the 1830s, Northerners developed a powerful moral critique of Southern slavery. The Second Great Awakening provided the religious foundation. salvation through personal initiative, the perfectibility of human nature and human society, and the fundamental right of all people to pursue and fulfill their God-given potential. At the same time, the Industrial Revolution contributed an additional economic dimension to the anti-slavery movement, the ideology of producerism, born on millions of family farms and in thousands of textile mills across the North. Producerism is the idea that the true value of any commodity lies in the labor, not the capital, invested in it. To extract it as a raw material and then process it into a finished product. And the fruits of that labor rightly belong not to the plantation owner, the mill owner, or the merchant, but to the laborer, whether a southern slave or a northern mill hand. As Abraham Lincoln expressed this rising sentiment so succinctly, the world is agreed that labor is the source from which human wants are mainly supplied. And, he said, all laborers have an inherent right to the products that they themselves produce. As each man has one mouth to be fed and one pair of hands to furnish food, it was probably intended that that particular pair of hands should feed that particular mouth. From this simple premise, Lincoln went on to articulate fully why slavery is immoral. During his famous debates with Stephen Douglas, for example, he contrasted himself as a white northern man with a female southern slave and declared that in some respects, she certainly is not my equal, but in her natural right to eat the bread she earns with her own hands without asking leave of anyone else, she is my equal and the equal of all others. This was the most important lesson that Lincoln, a native Southerner, had learned during his four decades living in the industrializing and urbanizing North. The great achievement of the voters who elected Lincoln in 1860 on that simple premise was to set aside their own economic interest in the form of cheap and plentiful Southern cotton for the sake of creating a more equitable, if still far from perfect, society. Cotton solidified slavery in the South, but it also fueled an economic and cultural transformation in the North that contained the seeds of its own destruction. In this sense, Lincoln's request that the U.S. Marine Band play Dixie acknowledged that America was still a land of cotton because cotton helped to make the nation what it was at that moment and what it would yet become. Thank you. And thank you.
Thank you. We certainly have time for questions. Any questions or comments?
Was there any acknowledged culpability among the northern producers of cloth that they were dependent on slave labor in the South for their what they were producing?
Could you repeat the question?
Yes. Was there any acknowledged culpability on the part of the textile mill owners that they depended on the labor of slaves, 4 million slaves, to generate their profits? Yes, they understood that. And many of them supported the Democratic Party in the North and opposed the anti-slavery movement as a result. For example, the Whig Party was the party of evangelical Protestantism. So most anti-slavery advocates were at one time or another Whigs, including Abraham Lincoln. Beginning in the late 1840s, the Whig Party divided because of slavery. Opponents of slavery in the Whig Party were called conscience Whigs. Lincoln was a conscience Whig. Supporters of slavery in the Whig Party were called cotton Whigs. And this was an alliance between wealthy mill owners and the mill hands who worked in the cotton factories. The cheap cotton paid their wages from their perspective. And this division was so bitter that it actually destroyed the Whig Party after the election of 1852. One way of looking at it is that the conscience Whigs won. And then, of course, in 1854, the Republican Party arose, and most early Republicans were former Whigs, mostly the conscience Whigs. So there was a profound repercussion in the North as the moral crusade against slavery came into conflict with the economic boom that cotton supported. Sure.
Kim, if I understood your conclusion, you suggested that the producer ideology trumped correct evangelical religious moral ideology.
I wouldn't say trumped. It complemented and amplified. Without the religious, moral foundation, anti-slavery would have gone nowhere. But not all Northerners were evangelical Protestants. And so this producerism ideology appealed to a much broader constituency. And I think Lincoln was intentionally secular in his argument against slavery for that reason, to appeal to a much broader potential anti-slavery constituency within the North. How much time do we have? I'm joking, but thank you, Ben. Yes. Yes. Well, oh, I'm sorry. 20, at different times, 25% of Southern cotton went to the North for processing. The other 75% went to England. How many ships would that take? The English had the largest merchant marine, the largest fleet of merchant vessels, as well as the largest fleet of naval vessels in the world at the time. And American ships as well carried the cotton across the Atlantic Ocean. It's often been said that Northerners profited more from the export of cotton than Southerners did. Their ships carried the cotton to England. They insured those ships. They financed those voyages, Northern banks. This was an immense infrastructure that England had created to fuel its own cotton mills. Yes. Yes. This is the question. The textile industry in New England presented opportunities for young women to leave family farms. Exactly. Women, as I said, women had always been charged with textile production at home. Well, first the spinning left the home, then the weaving left the home. This gave women a tremendous amount of newly found time, if nothing else. On the other hand, that was women's economic role and contribution to their families. So on one level, they lost that status and power that comes with economic production and became surplus labor on the family farm. Well, this freed them to leave. And because women had always produced textiles at home, the mill owners, without thinking innovatively, hired women, the so-called mill girls, to run the machines in the spinning and weaving mills. Most of the so-called mill girls worked for perhaps 2 years in between leaving home and marrying, because married women were not expected to work outside their homes. They were to concentrate on bearing children and raising them. So this represented a transition in which a girl, mill girl, young woman could leave home for a city. And of course, as we all know, the mills, particularly the Lowell Mill system, created dormitories. The first dormitories in America housed the female mill workers, and only later colleges borrowed the concept of a dormitory for their students, particularly their female students. Yes.
Hi.
Because England had already ended slavery at home and in its colonies, did anyone in England boycott American cotton? I don't know. I hope so, but I don't know. I don't believe that made a significant impact on the export of cotton to England, if they did. I don't know. But I'll find out. Thank you. Yes.
During the Civil War, the South imposed an embargo on shipments of cotton to England. What did that do to the post-war market of cotton as far as England was concerned?
Well, thank you. at the beginning of the Civil War, the Confederacy imposed an embargo on the export of cotton. And this sounds counterintuitive. They wanted Britain and France to recognize the Confederacy as a sovereign nation and perhaps provide military and economic aid. So they believed the best way to coerce the British into supporting the South, we supply 88% of their cotton, we'll just withhold it. They'll have to back down. It didn't work that way. The British simply turned to their other tropical and subtropical colonies, of which they had many at that time. The most important were India and Egypt, stepped up cultivation of cotton in those colonies, and they filled the want. Well, the second half of your question is, what did that do to the post-war market for cotton? The price plummeted. When the war ended, and Southerners had all the cotton in the world, or three-fourths of it, to sell, no one wanted it because of the new sources of cotton that Britain had and other countries had developed during the war. And this was, for the South, an economic blow of incredible proportions. The Southern agriculture economy did not recover where it had been in 1860 for 50 years in 1910 as a result. And Southerners simply, with the falling price, grew more cotton. They doubled production again and tripled it and quadrupled it, and that simply drove the price down farther. But they had created a monoculture. That's what they did. They grew cotton. They didn't even grow food, by and large. They imported food from the North. So that was devastating. Thank you.
Let's take one more question, if there's one.